Amy King, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, we're going to talk today about your book, I Want to Make You Safe, although you came out with a book after this. I was just so fascinated with this book, and I just got into it so much that I didn't realize you had come out with another one. Before we get to the one that we're going to talk about, I Want to Make You Safe, tell us a little bit about your latest book.
My latest book is called The Missing Museum and just came out this year, earlier this year. Well, I should say it came out a couple months ago, but you could get it early in advance right. If you paid attention. But it's a little more raucous than I Want to Make You Safe. It's a little more political, although I was just speaking with someone who said that they were afraid to read my poems because they know me through my Facebook posts.
Oh, no.
And she says, I guess she thought that my poetry would be very political, and I have a feeling she probably thought it would be a more Carolyn Forché style, which made me laugh because my poetry is anything but Carolyn Forché style. But yeah, the new book, it's got a little more political stuff in it. I mean, the first poem is about Putin, but not in the way you think. And it ranges in subject matter and deals with various aesthetic ideas. And anyway, it's something that I recommend it.
Well, I'm gonna go into that one next, and hopefully we can have you on the show again. But on this book, I Want to Make You Safe, like, you know, most books, you have some blurbs on the back, and there's this quote from Cole Swenson, and she says, "Language is a tool with social obligations." And I'm wondering if you agree with that, and how that, if you do agree with it, how that manifests itself in this particular book, I Want to Make You Safe.
Well, language does have societal obligations in that it is a shared tool of society. And so you would hope that people would use language responsibly.
Right.
And so I think as a poet, you know, basically I always talk to my students about how one is not, you know, the romantic idea that you just sit down and write poetry as though manna is flowing through your pen from heaven. Poets actually pay attention to how language, you know, sort of creates and affects meaning and how language is manipulated. And so a poet, I think, is someone who really focuses in on how people are affected and how meaning is shaped by language, which is why obviously poetry can be daunting too, because it is such a particular study without any one definitive, you know, focus. You know, like you can look at how poetry is political in the political realm, but how poetry can be used to police people in a personal way. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, language always has a societal obligation, especially poets themselves, to sort of draw attention to how language can be used to hurt and can be used to help people.
Right. You know, as I enter into your poems, I do encounter occasional references. I think there's a reference to Homeland Security, and there's just these references to the political milieu. But I don't feel like there's a really strong assertion of a political message. Did you want there to be, or is it just more that the language, no matter who you are and how you're using language, you're using it in a political way?
I use the word political with a lowercase p because I think that even when we talk about aesthetics, we're talking about some sort of set of values.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like, to, you know, even if we just try to say, well, people are, this is just an objective thing, we're just looking at it objectively, there's no such thing as an objective. I mean, even if you go into science, aside from sort of factual, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, or, you know, the boiling point of water is this, you can manipulate studies, you can look at studies and represent them in certain ways to reflect your own ideology or to push forward some belief you want to have confirmed. That's why you always ask, what's the source of the study, that sort of thing. And so that book that you're talking about, that you're looking at, is, I think it has a little bit more of an aesthetic bend to it in the sense of it's about language play and craft.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also a luxury, I think, too. It's got a little bit of a romantic sense, too. I mean, I haven't thought about this book in a little while, but I look at, you know, sort of how we interrelate in romantic ways, literally, but I also look at what does it mean to be a person walking through Brooklyn? I think that's one of the last poems in the book, or the longer poem.
The opera poem, yeah.
Yeah, the opera of peace. I think that even just aesthetics themselves represent a particular set of values, and to pretend that, I've never been a fan of people who say, well, you can't look at the values of the artist, or, you know, that shouldn't affect. Well, yeah, you can look at those things, because language is in the world and of the person who's using it. And so to pretend that there's some sort of remove, and there can be gradations of remove, you know, if you think about fiction, you're thinking about how somebody lives a life who's not a real person, right? And nonetheless, we're still using fiction to talk about life and values.
Right.
I mean, this is something that's really, really basic. I talk to my students about when you first start reading a story, there's a character who makes decisions in the face of a conflict, and what do you as the reader do? You automatically start judging them based on what you think their values are, how they're acting, you know, that sort of thing, what you think is compelling them. So it's all political to me.
Absolutely. You know, I think of that that argument about can one really enjoy the work of a jerk or the work of somebody who's just completely against everything you believe. And I'm thinking of when I read your poems, what allows me access to the images is your syntax, the way it unfolds down the page. And I just love entering into it. But the fact is, when we write that way, when we write, and I'm assuming this is how you write, and if I'm wrong, forgive me, you know, you follow language, you let a language lead the poem, that ultimately you're going to lose on the way into the language. You're going to lose pretension. You're going to lose how you want to present yourself publicly. You're going to lose really everything that is on the exterior, and you're going to go right to the heart of you. You're going to express stuff that's inside of there. And how can you be reprehensible jerk and and use language in such a way that is not going to represent that?
Yeah. I mean, if you are writing in a non-formulaic way, if you're, as you say, I mean, for me, writing insists on the intuitive, because that is about getting at what it is you're trying to not just express, because I don't think writers just express. I think writers explore. And yeah, you have a set of values that, I mean, we've inherited them, we've changed our minds about them, because based on our experience, et cetera. But we aren't, none of us are 100,000% certain on everything we know and everything we believe. And so writers, I think, take that risk and explore. And if you're just regurgitating in a formulaic way, like there are certain male writers who just cannot write a female character.
Absolutely.
Because they just keep coming out as these stereotypes of this object. I mean, and they just repeat the same kind of novel with different characters in a different setting regularly, and then they call great writers. I'm not talking about Norman Mailer or anything, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
There's this limitation, and it's so weird because there can aesthetically still be something pleasing, but it doesn't carry it at all.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Like, no, who goes to a Roman Polanski film the same way anymore when you go into how he's filmed a particular female character?
Right,
nobody.
Yeah.
You're informed by that. Even watching, like, The Cosby Show now, it takes on a whole different tone, you know?
Or Woody Allen. It's hard to watch Woody Allen now that we know what we know about him.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny, too, because it doesn't even just manifest in the Woody Allen is this guy who did this thing to his stepdaughter or whatever. To me, like, I've watched some more recent Woody Allen. I watched one that everybody's like, oh, you got to see the one where he goes back, I forget the guy's name, the blonde actor. He goes back in time
Owen
and
Wilson.
Meets Gertrude. Yeah, Owen Wilson, he meets Gertrude.
Oh, Midnight in Paris you're talking about.
Yeah. And I just watched this, and because I've already got these feelings about Woody Allen, I'm watching this and I'm like, every male character protagonist that Woody Allen, you can see Owen Wilson is totally being directed to be who Woody Allen seems himself as.
Absolutely.
It is so limiting. I can't even believe that Owen Wilson does this. He just literally acts like Woody Allen in it. And it's just so incredibly narcissistic, you know?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I was in grad school getting my MFA at the University of Oregon, it was just me and a poet named Andres Montoya. We're the only Latinos in the program. And we came out of Fresno, both of us. And Fresno was, you know, part of the birth of the Chicano movement. And so we were very political and very assertive with our politics, and we used to call Kraft Cracker Kraft. Shows how.
Yeah.
And even though we made a lot of errors in, you know, our perspective, we were just part of our development. We were just beginning. We used to insist every time we would end, we would read something from our peers or even something that was assigned, we would, you know, assert a political interpretation. And there was always this claim, oh, it's just art. Oh, it's just neutral. But
yeah. But
when you look at, for example, I teach creative writing here at the university. I haven't taught undergraduate courses in quite a while, but when I did, you would always have these male writers who would describe women as if it were an episode of Glee, just a lot of flesh and a lot of, you know, and when anyone pointed it out, they would say, oh, come on, it's not political. You're just reading into it. But no, you just can't separate. So I totally agree with that.
Right. And you also get the whole anti-intellectual bent of, why can't you just enjoy it?
Yeah.
It's beautiful. You know, she's a beautiful whatever. And it's like this pushback of like, don't you dare analyze. Don't be critical. There's, I mean, this is sort of on par with what we see right now, the whole, that's been going on. That, that we refer to it as the dumbing down of America or whatever, but there's this desire to limit the extent to which we plunge the depths and ask the questions and make the connections, you know, that when Woody Allen remakes these films, makes these films where they're all in his own image, and then I say, you know, he's narcissistic. Well, it takes someone who is incredibly narcissistic and probably sociopathic to do the things that he's been accused of doing, you know. So,
hey, I don't know if this is relevant, but you could walk into a restaurant in any city in the U.S., probably in the world, but mostly in the U.S. is where I've noticed it. And I'm talking about a place where it's, you know, a lot of business and it's kind of, and you could tell just by the servers if the manager is a male or a female. Because if it's a male, they usually, all the servers look alike. Very little variation in them. And so, we kind of unconsciously bring our values through the choices that we make, whether it's in language or anything else. But that's an interesting conversation. But I want to ask you about something to get back to your poems. You've been described as a language poet. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, label your poems or anything. But do you think that that's a good way to describe your work?
I think that got affixed because I studied with some language poets. I don't really think that's a good description. It carries a very specific set of values, and I mean, I think they were political and to a certain degree, and I do admire a lot of the people that they count as their sort of influences. Like, I studied a number of them, and I still sort of hold to some of them, like Ed Dorn, I think, is an amazing poet. But yeah, I was up in Buffalo when they were still there, Robert Creeley and Charles Bernstein, Susan Howe. But that was I was very young. I mean, for me, I was very young. I mean, I guess I was in my 20s at that point, but I don't even feel like I really grew as a poet until I left Buffalo and went to New York and didn't write for a few years and just read and explored and sort of evolved consciously about, you know, other, I guess, I don't know how to describe it, but just different awarenesses in society. And that had always been something I was aware of. But anyway, I've always heard that, like, there's never just, people have said to me, there's never been just one Amy King poem, and that's probably why reviewers have a tough time, you know.
That's a great compliment, isn't it?
I love it. I think it's wonderful. I mean, it hurts me, too, in the sense of, like, marketing me and my work, I should say. And, you know, I think it limits reviewers. I think people don't really know quite what to do because they, like, the book that you're looking at is, I would say, is quite different from the book that just came out. And, I mean, for me, I want to be that way because I always want to be open to exploring new styles and allowing my work to change what the focus is and to stay with the times. And, you know, maybe that'll mark me as a, you know, nobody will read my work in 20 years, I don't know. But for me, it's what's relevant now. And my work has been described in a number of different ways. And I've been blurred by a mix of people, like, that don't match up and aren't one particular school. And I just leave that to everybody else. I don't know how to describe my overall body of work so far because it is so ranging and But yeah, I wouldn't say I'm a language poet. Right. I would never call myself that.
Yeah,
In fact, they probably would hate that I would call myself that. Some of them I don't think are very keen on me right now.
Yeah, that's the thing. When you use labels, you suddenly get identified with a particular group. And also, I think, you know, you can't singularize your work by giving it a label. Attempts to singularize it. Like when I first started publishing, and I probably even still now, you know, I'm considered a Chicano writer.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times, there's unconscious demands on the form when they use that term, and you know, certain things that should or should not be in there. But I don't really reject the term, because if it sells books, fine, let them call me whatever they want. But on the other hand, I don't want to be just labeled. And you know, as we know, even if we look at the old patriarchal references, to name something is to conquer it, is to define it. And so,
right.
We wouldn't want to do that with our poetry, especially yours.
And to limit it, too. Certain. I mean, I have, I myself identify as gay, and I think there's been some very minor attempts to sort of, I mean, a review of my book just came out in the Lambda, but if there is real sapphic content in there, it's not really prominent, or it's very small and fleeting. I mean, there's just not... So the only label that I think is actually sort of closer to true is sometimes I'll get called a queer poet, but only to me that's not necessarily a sexual label.
No. Yeah.
Per se, it's more of just like that which does not fit into a box well. I mean, I always like the idea of the queer being the perverted or the unusual, whatever. Right. I actually wrote an essay that you can see online called The What Else of Queer Poetry, and people who are strict about the labels, I don't know that they would necessarily like that essay, but it sort of delimits it in that it allows, you know, any number of people to write queer poetry.
Right. I think that's how I first heard you reference before I even entered into your book. And perhaps, you know, as I was going into it, I was looking out for that, but I lost all consciousness that that's what I was looking at. And what I love is, you know, not to... you know, call you a language poet. You're not a language poet, but I love the language. I just love entering into your syntax and not knowing where it's going to lead me. And I'm looking at a poem right now. I'm looking at Thanking God You're Connecting Things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to read one sentence, one syntactical construction. There's always corn, but I thought of lobbing opal green butterflies, a swamp snap of lightning for the mastery of suddenly sick and not knowing if I should or shouldn't stop, what stop was, what I was up against, a cotton gin, the cotton plant calling, an extraction of sharp rubber flavor, a person to come along bearing down with pant legs that rip the white from its seedling eye out. Forgive, you know, my reading of that. I know probably not how you would read it, but I just love that syntax. I don't know where it's going to take me, and and I'm just willing to go wherever it is. And on the way, it's delivering me these amazing images, like lobbing opal green butterflies. And even though the images, you know, may have more poetic sense than literal sense, I feel like I'm just floating inside of your work. So I want to talk about the process. How do you start with a poem? Is it like maybe a clause of the syntax? Is it a rhythm? Is it? I don't suspect it's an idea. Okay, I want to say, make a statement about this.
Mm-hmm.
If you could just try to explain, just so I know how, geez, how I could try something like this, because I am so fascinated by what you can do if I follow your language.
Thank you. That's great. As I said, for me, poetry is very much about exploring, not just about, you know, sort of replicating or whatever. But that what you just read, if you want to summarize it, to me, I don't remember my work. I mean, that's fresh to me.
Because
it's an exploration, people will often read to me lines and I'm just like, that's great. Who's that? And they're like, that's you. But like that line that you just read or sentence or whatever it is, the summary of it is, to me, it just sounds like somebody has walked through a field where some cotton's growing and they saw a butterfly. But to say it that way sounds ridiculous. It doesn't. The line you read, to me, conveys motion. It conveys movement. It conveys the way we process the world. This is a person who notices the butterfly, notices the things attaching to themselves, and the syntax allows for that sense of movement.
Mm.
And as I mentioned earlier, I think as a writer, you have to allow the intuitive to come out rather than just you know, you can sit down with an idea, and that's your intellectual part. This is the Western way of thinking. Well, my brain is at work now.
Right.
You know, and I don't always know how I achieve these things. I think in the past we've heard people, I try to get my students to do what's called, obviously, free writing, but people try to achieve this state in a lot of different ways. I think in the past I've said you should drink a glass of wine to let loose. You got to get rid of that editor. It's really about getting rid of that Western way of thinking of, like, my mind is not quite the same as my body. And, you know, just trying to find some way to be present and allow. It's almost like that thing, I'm sure everyone is familiar with it and has felt it at some point in their lives, where they've done the Zen moment of, if you go to the pool table or you go up to the bat or whatever, and you think too hard about it, then you're thinking, is my foot in the right place? Is my hand here? Am I going to be able to calculate the right way the ball should hit? If you go to a Zen state where you're not all mind and you're not all aware of yourself, and you just allow your body to relax and feel it, then you do that thing, that beautiful execution of just hitting the ball exactly the right way without thinking, okay, all of these muscles are working in this particular way, and then it comes out. And I think it's really hard because we are working in language, which does come from that center of our brain that intellectualizes and very, you know, that's how we think, our thoughts is in language. But you can kind of get there. I mean, when I teach my students, I say, you know, listen to music and don't worry, you can steal lyrics, but you can also let that energy, if you're listening to a fast-paced song or a hard or a soft or whatever, let it carry you to wherever it's carrying you and then let that affect the way you're writing. Same thing with a painting. I say paintings are not just about what is being represented, but there's also color conveys an energy. The shapes can suggest a movement or whatever. And so for me, that's what I'm trying to do in language, is trying to let loose and see and exist in a way that I'm letting the language sort of flow with whatever is happening at the moment. And I guess in that moment, I was walking, in my head at least, I was walking through a field.
Yeah. We're talking to Amy King about her book, I Want to Make You Safe. And that line, that part of a poem, because they were very short lines and it went down the page, you said you thought about walking through a field and seeing a butterfly, which is really beautiful. And it kind of added a depth for me, but it's certainly not what I was thinking as I was reading it. And it makes me think about language is clearly leading these poems, and it's also defining, to some extent, the meaning, should one feel the desire to go into your poems and extract particular meanings. But the image of walking through a field, there's two kinds of thinking. There's the thinking that is close to language. It's when we're, you know, we're actually completing sentences or talking to ourselves, or we're thinking and there's clear language going on. And then there's a kind of thinking where there is no language, and that's kind of a more intimate, closer to whatever the source is type of thinking. And what's really interesting is, even though this is the language that's leading us into this field, it almost seems like it's a language that's expressing non-languagey thought.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah, because it's beyond just the simple summary of a person walking through a field.
Thinking. And because most of us, I mean, really the most intimate thinking is not in language. Yet at the same time, if we ever try to access that, we would only be able to do it through language.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
You were talking about...
Derridian, too. I just was saying I like to read things that I don't understand. And years ago, I used to read Derrida, and that was something he would get at, you know.
Well, I love to read things I don't understand, as long as I'm able to enjoy getting there and being there. And you wrote an essay in the Boston Review, a beautiful essay. You say poetry is unto death, both simply are inexplicable, unjustified, mercurially undefined, ever-present, jolting, disruptive. It's a really beautiful review. I don't understand it all, but I think that's part of the whole meaning of the essay. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't feel like I really need to cling to anything when I'm entering your work, except for, again, the language. But you were talking about giving exercises to your students, and you were talking about music, and there's this particular poem you call If Two by Land I Do. I don't know if you remember it, but it kind of has this refrain, I do you want, do you want, do you want? I think that poem in particular would be a good exercise for students of poetry. It's a beautiful poem, and I want is so charged with desire, that you'll never know if you're following the language where you're going to go with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's about desire and where is that leading you?
Yeah, and you know, in fiction, I'm a fiction writer. One of the first things you begin to articulate when you're teaching it is how plot is really where the character's desire leads. That's what the plot of a story is. Being led by desire. A story is led by desire. Would you be willing to read a poem? Anything you want, maybe something from your new collection?
Sure. I just pulled up online a poem from the book you're talking about, When I Make You Safe.
Oh, great. It's
called Men by the Lips of Women.
Oh, yes. I remember that one. I love that one.
Men by the Lips of Women. I'm in love with a man who doesn't love me, with the pages of the book he sees from. He makes love through his syllabic ink, a salted thunder, leaves me to my own delirium tremors. I gouge out his eyes, break the yolk across his shoulders, disembowel the nectar from his liver. His toxins become a cherry blossom wine. He sounds in the brain's eagled hollows of a soft guitar from a Spanish cafe among the mountain peaks in nightshade. He cannot hide, no matter how many goats he scares or biscuits he throws at the hunger. The mother of everyone calls him. His fright is an orb of hold me, I'm yours, crisp and curled with ages yellow and the godless sunburn you love across your nose. I am that love you light yourself with, and my gender is powerless in this. We are metered only by our own machines, while the book is a clock that forgets her mechanics. Her hands can count, but would rather wipe warm dew, the pall from your lips, and kiss the lids of your eyes from sleep. Here am I, is he, with yoke and shadow removed. She is, her and me, apart from you, man reading men by the lips of women.
That was Amy King reading from her book, I Want to Make You Safe. Amy, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire. Check out this book and her newest one, which is called...
It's called The Missing Museum.
The Missing Museum. Mm-hmm. That's a very intriguing title. It almost sounds like there's a parallel universe with a museum in it, and you got to find the portal to get inside of it. And my God, what you might see in there.
It's a little bit more energized than the... I Want to Make You Safe. I Want to Make You Safe is actually a bit safer.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us and wish you the best of luck.
And thank you for having me, Daniel.